Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HOURENERGY.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
Hey, Tommy, you just took a road trip.
I sure did. I just took our Ford Bronco on an 800-mile summer road trip.
Yeah, so that gave us the idea of talking about the best road trip cars for the summer because, let's face it, it's road trip season.
Absolutely, yeah, and we thought we should compile a little list of the best cars to accompany you on your summer adventures.
Except there's a problem.
Okay.
And that is, I really believe this, that the best road trip car is actually a truck.
Well, we can talk about that. That's an interesting viewpoint.
I don't want to step on Andre's toes. You know, he's got that truck podcast, right? And I don't want to be, like, talking about trucks when we're the car podcast. So
I say we go with it.
You say we step on his toes?
Yes, I say we step right over his toes. I think that the audience should know what the best road trip vehicles are.
All right, so here's my criteria. First, let's establish the criteria, okay? And then we'll talk about your road trip in the Bronco. For me, a road trip vehicle, first and foremost, has to be comfortable.
Okay.
That's why trucks are great, because they're big and they've got lots of room and they have lots of cup holders. The downside, of course, is you have no place to put your stuff, but that's a whole other discussion that we'll leave for Andre. Number two, I think they have to be off-road capable, because when I go road tripping, Tommy, I want to go off-roading at some point.
Well, I think that depends on your road trip, because some folks have no interest in going in the dirt and some folks just want the fuel economy benefit of an on-road car.
Yeah, and then that was number three, actually. You got to it before I did. And that is the ability to have pretty good fuel economy. I mean, you know, fuel prices are through the roof right now. So we're very well aware of that. So in this podcast, we're not just going to talk about the obvious road trip cars like, you know, like the Tahoe and the Land Cruisers of the world. But we're going to talk about, like, small cars that actually you can road trip and not, you know, put a huge dent in your wallet.
Right. Very good point. Yep.
So let's start with your Bronco road trip. Tell me, where did you go? And a Bronco is an odd choice, especially when rolling on 35s, because it's not exactly the most fuel-efficient car. It's not exactly the most comfortable car in some ways. But tell me about it. Where'd you go and how was it?
Well, we started in Boulder, our location here in Colorado, which is about 45 minutes from Denver, Colorado. And then we decided to go northwest. So we went up I-70 through the Rocky Mountains to a city called Steamboat Springs.
And who's we?
Me and my buddy Kira.
Okay.
And then in Steamboat Springs, we spent the night before continuing on to the Utah border, where we went and saw the Dinosaur National Monument, because we've been collecting these little stamps from the different national parks and monuments from around the country. And then from Dinosaur National Monument, we went south back to I-70, back through the Rocky Mountains to a place called Keystone, Colorado, and then ended up back in Boulder. So we had a bunch of cool little adventures, saw a bunch of cool things. It was a great trip.
How many miles?
Totally, it was like 800 miles exactly. It's just under maybe 790-something. But the Bronco performed very, very well. I took the Bronco because I wanted to see how it was as a road tripper. We've done a lot of road trips in Wranglers and FJ Cruisers and 4Runners and all of it, but I've never done one in the Bronco, so I wanted to get that experience.
So tell me, how does it compare to Wranglers and FJ Cruisers and, you know, the other pretty serious off-roaders?
Well, I think it certainly is a lot better than the Wrangler on a road trip. I love the additional kind of width and the space in the Bronco. So I love how the Wrangler is nice and small and compact. But having that kind of additional shoulder room and leg room that the Bronco allows meant that it's just a much more comfortable way to spend a lot of time. So that was certainly a big pro of the Ford over the Jeep. I also think the ride is probably a little better when you're cruising down the highway at 75, 80 and you hit an expansion joint. the suspension seems to perform better on the Ford than the Wrangler.
Yeah, independent front suspension is better on the highway, I think, than solid axles.
For sure. And then I was also pretty impressed with the fuel economy. So I think we averaged like 19.6, 19.7, which isn't too bad for a twin-turbo V6 on 35-inch tall tires and essentially bricking the wind. But yeah, the cool thing about road tripping a Bronco or Wrangler is you can get to your destination and then you can pull the roof back.
Yeah, right? you had that best top Sunrider, right?
Absolutely, yeah. You could just fold it back, or if you were so inclined, you could also pull out doors.
So if you guys are wondering, you know, we bought our Bronco a year ago now almost, and we were one of the first ones. It's a first edition, so it was $63,000, all the bells and whistles, and that'll become important in a second because we're going to talk about one of its features, or lack thereof. It came with that top that was squeaky, and we finally got the replacement top from Ford, and so we had a best top, soft top on it, which I just absolutely loved. But let's face it, soft tops are a little loud on the highway, so when you're road tripping, it gets tiring, right? So now we put the new hard top on. Did they take the old one, you know? I think Ford took the old one. Yeah, they wanted the old one.
Which, do you think that's ever going to be really valuable? Do you think, like, in 50 years' time when people are collecting the first edition Broncos?
That they'll want the bad top, the squeaky one?
Well, it was called the MIC 1.0 is what it's made, mold and color. And then it was a version 1.0 because it had all sorts of problems. But I bet you it's like defective Hot Wheels. Where in like 50 years from now,
it could be.
People There's... are going to collect the ones that are... Because they didn't make many of them. It was only the very first batches of the hard tops. Because remember, most of the Broncos shipped with soft tops. So we had a very rare top, and we may have just lost out on like $20,000 in 2050 money.
Yeah, I'm not worried about it. Yeah, I know. Like people, like if you collect coins or stamps, right? That the most valuable
the defective
stamp
ones.
Is that upside down airplane stamp, or if there's a stamping of a coin and somehow the die is starting to break, then those are the most valuable. There's a whole world of collecting these like oddball rare things. So maybe you're right, but you know what? I need to drive the thing, so I don't want the sound of like little elves mining gold above my head because it was squeaky and rattly and loud. So we put a Sunrider top on the thing from Best Top, and that's basically replaces those two panels in the front so that when you want, you can just push it back and get access to the sun. And did you like that? Did you use it?
We used it once, yeah, and it was quite nice. I certainly the Best Top Sunrider is still a little bit louder than the traditional fixed panels that you'd get on the hard top, but it was a very pleasurable experience to kind of open it up and let the sunshine in. But yeah, I mean, think that the thing that Ford really nailed is the on-road dynamics are quite good for a vehicle on 35-inch tall tires. I thought the fuel economy was good. Passing power is really good from about 10 to 70 miles an hour. Over 70, things kind of fall off a cliff a little bit, then it kind of starts to huff and puff.
Really? 300 horsepower ain't enough?
Well, it's got 5,000 pounds worth of Sasquatched Bronco, so it's really pushing it. And then the radio, I still don't think the radio is very good for what you pay. So this is a $60,000 plus Bronco. But the issue is you've got speakers all the way in the front and then speakers all the way in the back. But unlike the Jeep, there's no speakers above your head, so there's not a lot of depth in the radio. When you're really trying to pump your tunes.
Especially when you got like a soft top over your head, right? That's maybe making a little bit more noise.
That's right. Exactly right. But the seats are 1,000 times better than the Jeep. Now, I think compared to a 4Runner, it probably still is a little better because I think the technology is better in the Bronco. Like, we used wireless Apple CarPlay the whole time, and it was fantastic.
You know what's crazy with the 4Runner? It's like the oldest truck in the segment now, and it just keeps selling more and more every year.
Yeah. Well, it's good.
We just did a video with a new one. It's up on alltfl.com, so check that out. If you haven't added it to your phone yet, just go to alltfl and you can add it as a little web app to your phone, and then you can see that video. Toyota didn't do a lot with the new 4Runner, unfortunately, for 2023. Or fortunately, if you love the old one, I guess, they gave it like a midnight package.
Well, they gave it that 40th anniversary one, too, which I think looks really
That's kind of cool with the livery.
Yeah, I think it looks really, really good. But I think that the 4Runner has similar on-road dynamics. It's a little bit quieter, for certain, because it's a fixed roof, right? I thought the interior comfort is also very good on the 4Runner. It does not nearly have the same kind of passing power as the Ford. I think that the 4-liter, especially at altitude, is not quite as willing to scoot by trucks when you need it to. And the technology isn't as good as the Ford. So the wireless sync system is just incredible on the Ford. And the integration with your phone is really, really fast and snappy. And you can have multiple widgets running at one time. And it's really, really handy for that. But the 4Runner is a good road tripper. Downside of the 4Runner is also fuel economy is going to be pretty rough.
Yeah, you know, the great thing about all these vehicles, be it a Wrangler, a 4Runner, Bronco, or even, I would say, even a Defender, which is kind of getting up there in price, is, you know, when you're road tripping, for me at least, the cool part is, like, you just have stuff everywhere, right? You've got your dog, and it's just a bit of a time where you can be messy and not worry about the interior quality or, you know, spillage in the car. So I love the fact that you can have beef jerky and potato chips and, you know, all this stuff just kind of all over the place and it spills on the floor. But because it's an off-roader, it's kind of designed for that. So you can just kind of bring it home and just hose it off as opposed to like worrying about picking up melted Sour Patch Kids from, you know, carpet.
Okay. And that's in what vehicle?
Any of these off-roaders. That's why I think they're great road trip cars, because you can just kind of, you know, treat them a little bit like a rent-a-car.
Yeah, you say that, but it doesn't actually work out like that.
No, tell me.
No, because every Wrangler for some reason has carpet in it. So you make it sound like you just spray out a tub, but no, every Wrangler has carpet in it.
But you don't feel bad, like, you know, getting...
You do!
Getting, like your dog jumps out and jumps back in with muddy paws, and you don't feel bad about getting muddy paws on the vehicle because you can just hose it off.
No, you cannot hose it off because it's got carpet in it. This is one of the big problems that Jeep needs to address, which Ford has done a really good job with. You can get the Bronco with a full vinyl interior, with vinyl floors, plastic flooring, plastic seating. The Wrangler, you have to get carpet. I'm like, why? Why do I have to get carpet?
I keep kind of inadvertently promoting our sponsors, right? WeatherTech.
Yep.
So, for instance, you know, we've put WeatherTech mats into some of our trucks, and I just love them. I think they're just so much, because I'm very anal about keeping my vehicle clean, and I hate, especially like with carpets, you know, getting stuff and dirt, because it just makes the vehicle look really unkempt.
And it's a good solution, but stuff still gets underneath the mat and stuff gets around the pedals. And
that's true, yeah.
I mean, I would argue that especially the 4Runner is very hard to clean out from a washability standpoint. I think that's one of those things where all the manufacturers tote. Oh, you can spray it out. No one is spraying out their infotainment system in their $60,000 Bronco.
Maybe I said that wrong. You're not going to take a hose and spray it out, but in the Bronco, I don't feel bad about having drinks and food and dogs and dirt in the thing, because it feels like it's designed to go off-road, so it feels like it's designed to get dirty. And Tommy, you have to admit, when we go to like Moab and run the White Room Trail, our vehicles come back like covered in dust and grime and dirt.
Yeah, oh, for sure. But I think certainly there's certain parts of the Bronco that are easier to clean out than a standard vehicle, like the dash is a plastic dash. A lot of the buttons have been designed
rubberized
in such a way where they can get wet, and yeah, they're not going to break. But this is kind of one of the big misconceptions where you're just like, oh, just take a hose and a rag and it'll be clean in 10 seconds. That was like what was one of the first vehicles to do that was like the Honda Element. That was its big thing, or you could hose it out. I'm not sure anyone has ever taken a hose to an Element.
So we just have the F-Pace here, okay?
Yeah.
And that is, how much was it?
$73,000, I think.
$73,000, beautiful interior, leather and real wood, right? And it just felt very expensive and very chic. And on a road trip, I would feel bad about that, because now I'm driving and I'm stinky and I'm getting the car stinky and I'm eating chips and... you know, pistachios and getting pistachios. I would just feel horrible about getting all that stuff inside the Jaguar. But in a Bronco or a Wrangler or even a Defender, I'd feel pretty comfortable with that.
Yeah, okay.
All right, is that fair? All right, so let's talk about the more interesting thing, and that is we found that there is some misunderstandings about the way that vehicles drive down the road by themselves. And we had this issue with actually the Bronco. Somebody made a comment in the video, you said, and you said that the car does not have lane centering. And somebody said, yes, it does have lane centering. But we need to talk about kind of basically three different levels of technology that help on a road trip, but that are very different and that are often confused, right? So the first level of technology, the entry level, is what I would call lane keep, all right? And this is a system whereby the vehicle either uses cameras and it sees the lane lines, and what it does is either warns you when you're about to go over a lane line or nudges the steering wheel to put you back in the lane that you want to be in. And what ends up happening in real world terms when you have lane keep is it's basically a way for the vehicle to warn you and keep you on the road, but it's not self-driving technology. So you end up ping-pong between the left and right lane, right? So it sees the left lane, it corrects, it goes in the right lane, corrects, goes in the left lane, corrects. And that's the feature that the Bronco has.
Well, maybe we should explain. Can I
break it
down a little further? So the three technologies: lane departure warning,
yeah,
lane keep assist, lane centering. And that is from the least assistance to the most assistance.
And then the fourth one would be like Blue Cruise. We'll get to that.
So,
which is hands-off driving.
Lane departure warning. It's a light or a buzzer letting you know you're leaving the lane. Lane keep assist. It'll nudge you back into the middle of the lane if you touch the line. Lane centering. It's got a set of sensors which will keep you centered in the lane as long as you have a hand on the steering wheel. So it's doing 90% of the driving itself.
And then like Blue Cruise or Active Glide if you're Lincoln or full self-driving if you're Tesla.
Or Super Cruise is
hands-off.
No, not Tesla, actually.
Not Tesla. No, Super Cruise, GM,
so,
and GM.
Super Cruise and now Blue Cruise, and then the Lincoln system is on pre-mapped highways. It will drive itself as long as you're paying attention. But you completely hands-off. You don't have to have feet on the pedals, no hands on the steering wheel.
So then you add cruise control to that is...
Adaptive,
and then basically you've got a vehicle, especially with lane centering, that basically drives itself as long as you've got your hands on the wheel, depending on how fast you're going, how many corners you're entering, right? With lane centering and adaptive cruise control, you're basically just watching the vehicle as it drives itself.
So let's talk about where
on a highway, doesn't change lanes, doesn't.
No, but that's actually not true, because on a You're confusing folks here a lot.
I don't think so. I think
lane centering will work on any road. Lane centering will work on a back road. Lane centering will work on any place where you have distinctive lines. Blue Cruise and Super Cruise only works on pre-mapped highways. So it's an important distinction which we want to make there. Now let's talk about where the Bronco...
Actually, I disagree. I don't think lane centering works on any road. And I'll give you an example. When we go up to the ranch, this is a two-lane road. And there's a dogleg right that we have to take at one point. You can turn lane centering on, and it will not make that dogleg.
But it will attempt to make it.
But it won't make it.
And in between the doglegs, when it's straight and gentle turns, it'll work.
Right, but that's what I'm saying. It's mainly a highway system, because the second you hit a dogleg, or the second you have to make a turn, because usually when you're in a secondary road, you've got to make a lot of turns, it doesn't work.
But here's why I want to make it an important distinction. You can activate it on any road.
Right, but I think these are all highway
you
systems.
You can't activate Blue Cruise on any road.
I think I don't want to confuse people, because to me it seems like I would never even think about using it on a country road, because I'm also not driving very far. I'm going to make turns. There's tractors coming in and off the road. There's cars, you know. To me, these technologies always work best on highways.
Well, let me give you an example of my trip. So I did 800 miles,
okay,
and I did not touch a single highway, and I would have loved that system.
Yes, you did. You did touch. That's
not
true.
Well, I went on I-70 for maybe 150 miles.
All right.
But all the way up through Steamboat, and then past Steamboat especially, are just two-lane roads for miles and miles with nothing. There are no truck centering. There are really no turns in a lot of instances. And that is where I would love to have lane centering or Blue Cruise, where it's just miles and miles and miles of just two lanes with perfectly dictated markers and not a lot of traffic. So that would be a great place for it. But it's not like an interstate, right, where you've got three lanes in each direction or two lanes in each direction, and there's on-ramps and off-ramps. I mean, these are two-lane roads, but there's just nothing and nothing and nothing for miles. And I would feel very comfortable supervising a lane-keeping system. So where the Bronco fits into the scale, so let's go all the way back to the beginning. Does it have lane departure warning? It does. So it will vibrate the steering wheel, and it will flash a warning if you're about to leave the lane. Does it have lane keep assist? I'm told it does. There's a setting. I didn't have it on because I think lane keep assist is very annoying, but it'll kind of ping pong you, as you said, back into the middle if you leave. Does it have lane centering where it'll maintain the middle of the lane? That I believe it does not. So the Bronco Sport is able to be spec'd with lane centering where it'll keep you right in the middle of the lane, hands on, paying attention, but it's doing 90% of the driving. The full size Bronco does not. Does it have Blue Cruise? It also does not in this current form. So you've got two of the kind of four possible autonomous tech features.
Yeah, but that's because Blue Cruise is only available on certain Ford vehicles right now.
Yeah, but I would imagine it's going to be like Super Cruise, where it starts out in the expensive stuff and then kind of trickles its way down to the affordable stuff.
$63,000 is expensive.
Yeah, I agree. But maybe like, I mean, more of the premium offerings, like on the high-end F-Series, double platinum, diamond reserve.
So we had, this is, I think, also another, let's just switch gears to another, what I think is a really good road trip car, and that is the Subaru Crosstrek. And once again, full disclosure, Subaru does not lend us cars, so we had to end up buying that car. so that we could test it. And then Ian, our videographer, bought it, and he's very happy with it. So the Crosstrek has Subaru's EyeSight, right, which is basically
lane centering.
Yep. And it worked really well. It actually works really well, and it's available on all their models, including the base model, which we had. So we had lane centering on a car that cost us $23,500 a year and a half ago.
Now, I would make the argument that it it works fairly well, but it gives up far too easily, and when it gives up, it is alarming.
Yeah.
So
you're driving along, and all of a sudden, it like raises his hands and says, "I can't do this. There's a curb, and you got to be ready to take
control."
And
some vehicles give you more warning when it feels like it's about to give up. I felt like the Subaru did a really poor job of that. It would just turn off if you hit a turn in I-70 that was too sharp for it. So I'm really not impressed with the Subaru EyeSight system from that Crosstrek. Because of that. Now, 85% of the time it works great, and the fact that you can get it on a $24,000 car is phenomenal, but I felt that that was a pretty big safety hazard, because there were a few times where you're, you know, you got your hand on the steering wheel, but you're just kind of, you know, listening to music, paying attention to the road, and then all of a sudden the steering wheel stops responding, and you have to take control immediately.
So let me give you an example of what Tommy's talking about. So we would drive from here to Keystone, for instance, and you get on I-70, and there's a section when you go over Floyd Hill, you come down the hill, and then there's a very twisty section right before Idaho Springs. So you're on a two-lane, four-lane highway, but it's very tight and twisty. The speed limit slows down, and that's where, like, the Subaru gives up the ghost. It'll just say, I can't do this. So there's too much speed and too many turns, and what happens is it just kind of gives up, and then you have to be ready at that moment to take control. And if you're in traffic or if there's a semi next to you, it's pretty scary. So that's the downside. But the upside is that it, you know, it has a feature that our $63,000 Bronco doesn't have. And speaking of the Bronco, if you look in this picture, you can't see it, but there's a hole under the muffler where I think you have one of the sensors.
Under the muffler?
I mean, under the front bumper.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, under the front bumper, where there's a little box, a little black box, and I think that's for adaptive cruise control, because there's also sensors by the rear view mirror. And I'm always wondering, how do you put a winch in there if you've got that, like, adaptive cruise control sensor in that hole where normally you would have a winch?
Oh, well, what a great question. I also wonder that. Now, the best, in my opinion, autonomous assistance technology. I was just in the new Hyundai, and this is the Ioniq 5. It's the electric car, and they have basically what we've been talking about. It's got lane centering, but it's highly, highly, highly advanced lane centering. So rather than just keeping you in the center of the lane, the system is very aware of surroundings. So if a large truck starts passing you on the left, the lane centering system will actually shift you over a little bit to the right position in the lane, so you get bigger clearance between you and the truck. So it's constantly monitoring around the vehicle. It's not just a fixed position in the middle of the lane. It'll scoot left and right within reason, of course. So I thought that was really, really clever. But yeah, I mean, the Ford, it would be nice if it had that lane centering feature, or Blue Cruise.
So let's dig a little deeper on this, because I think this is a really important road trip feature, especially if you're going far. It's nice to have these aids. And I was recently driving the Lightning, right, the Ford. And we can talk about electric car road tripping, because we've done that as well. But I was driving the Ford F-150 Lightning using Blue Cruise, which is their completely hands-off autonomous driving system. And the one thing that I found really disconcerting is, and I think the manufacturers are working on this, so they're trying to get better at it, but right now the system does not have what I would consider like natural or naturalistic functionality. So it brakes and steers and drives a car the way a computer would,
okay,
not the way that I would. And that can be a little bit disconcerting at best and very frightening at worst. So what I mean by that is, like, it waits just a hair too long to hit the brakes if the car in front of you stops. So what I'm always doing when I'm driving and the car in front of me stops is I put my brakes on a lot earlier, because I always figure that there's going to be some car who's going to decide to dart in front of me at that exact moment, right? And then I'm going to be in a very precarious and dangerous situation. The Ford waits almost, you know, a second too long before it starts. It will stop. It won't hit the car in front of you. But if there was a car that decided to merge into that lane, I think things would get ugly really quick, or it would throw up its hands and it would say, you take over. And so I always feel a little uncomfortable. And yeah, like you were talking about, like it drives too close to the semi-truck because it's a computer. It doesn't care. I don't want to be next to that 18-wheeler, you know, for very long, nor do I want to be very close to it. So like when I'm passing an 18-wheeler, I speed up just to get past that guy. And I give him a lot of room because I know the stopping distance that he needs, you know, if he's hauling 50 to 80,000 tons, right, which is what those things can do. No, pounds, sorry, not tons. Pounds, yeah, pounds. So I think there's still a lot of work to be done where people feel comfortable letting the vehicle drive itself. But right now, I'm always on edge using Blue Cruise or I haven't actually tried, what's GM system? Super Cruise.
So this is certainly further down the road than I think a lot of folks are going to be comfortable with. I mean, even lane centering is a weird sensation where you're holding onto the wheel, but it's doing the steering. But Blue Cruise and Super Cruise are completely hands-off. Now, there's a lot of technology that goes into it to make sure that you're not texting and reading a book. Or like the Cadillac I was in recently, the Escalade, has little sensors that are looking at your eyes, although I do question whether or not they are constantly looking at your eyes. But that is a very interesting system because that is like you can have your hands in your pockets and it will still do the driving. So that is a pretty alarming bit of tech, but I will say from the little bit I drove the Cadillac on Super Cruise, and once again, it's only on pre-mapped highways. So some engineers had to go out and drive however thousands of miles of interstate is mapped to make sure that it's like a safe highway that doesn't have all sorts of weird bends and turns and trees. And you know. But there's a lot of highways that it'll work on, and it is a very cool system where you're just letting the car do its thing and you are paying attention, but not touching anything.
And I think we're still at the beginning of this. We're 1.0. I'll give you an example of that. So we have a Santa Cruz long-term that Hyundai lent us, which is a little compact pickup truck. And I drive that quite a bit. And the one thing I have found that is super annoying with that car is, and by the way, it has lane centering without adaptive cruise control, which is weird. So it's got regular cruise control, but not adaptive. We had that conversation in the last podcast, so I won't bore you with that. But every so often, for as far as I can tell, no particular reason, I get that little chime and that little warning that comes up in one of the clusters that says, consider taking a coffee break. I could be like wide awake. It's first thing in the morning. I've just done my run. I am about as alert as I can be. And all of a sudden, the thing will be like, consider taking a coffee break. And I'm like, I'm really good. And there's no way to tell the car that, right? That's the problem. It's the worst thing that I hate with technology is when the car assumes things and does things that I don't want it to do because it thinks that it's smarter than me. Another example of that is like, we just had this problem with the Jaguar where I like having on the home screen, I like having the radio display on because I change the radio station a lot. And every time you start it up, it defaults to that main screen where you've got, audio, navigation, and whatever the third one is. And I'm just why do I have to keep putting it on the radio screen the first thing when I walk into the car? Anything like that where it's just repetitive and stupid and it doesn't learn really drives me bonkers.
Well, I think, though... Yeah. I mean, we're in a kind of a unique position where we only get these cars for a few days to test.
Right.
And I think if you own that car and you really wanted to, a lot of this stuff is customizable. So, for example, like...
I think that's a cop-out excuse.
No, but it is. Because, I mean, I think about this a lot. Like, one of my friends just bought a Subaru and I had a complaint about our Crosstrek and she had that complaint initially and then she went into the setting, changed the setting, she's had the car for 6 months now and it hasn't happened again. So I think that if you own the vehicle, you do figure out that there are ways to turn a lot of the stuff off. I mean, we don't have an opportunity a lot of times to go deep into the settings.
I completely disagree with that, and I'll tell you why. Because first of all, we own the Land Rover Defender and had that same system, so it always defaults to that same home screen.
Well, I never went and looked, though. I didn't know you didn't like it that much. I think if we had dove in there.
But let me finish, okay? So let's say, I don't know if it's changeable or not, but if it is changeable, it's going to be, you know, some buried menu somewhere where you're going to have to go through 14 different menus to find it, and then you may or may not find it, or you're going to have to go online.
But you only do it once, then.
Or Google it. I understand you only have to do it. But, Tommy, it's not just that one thing. It's everything. Like, we're flying to Europe today, actually, to go drive a Mini, and I probably spent a good 45 minutes of my time trying to figure out what my login to Lufthansa's website was so I could actually get my boarding pass, right? So I really have less than zero tolerance for having to, forcing me to go and dive into a menu after I spent the whole day fighting technology because the technology is stupid. I'm tired of stupid technology. Customizable technology is not smart. It just forces me to have to go figure out another operating system, right? And we have to do that with every app that you download. You have to do that on every phone you use. You have to do that on every computer. You have to do that now when you go to the grocery store. You know, there are all these companies who are doing what they used to do because it's cheaper and easier for them to foist it on you, right? Whether it's going to the grocery store and having you check out your own groceries, or whether it's having you do your own banking, right? It's just becoming too much technology. And when I come home in that Jaguar, if it's mine, right, and I gotta go feed the dog, and all of a sudden I realize I have no dog food, so I have to go to the dog food store. The last thing I wanna do is spend, you know, the few moments of my life that I have to myself trying to figure out how to customize my car so that it doesn't do something as blatantly stupid as keep the same page up. So that's why I disagree. I think manufacturers should not create technology that forces itself on me. And the same thing can be said for, like, you know, we just bought that ZR2, right? The ZR2 makes you basically subscribe to get all these premium services, right? That's just a way for GM to make money. Stuff that used to be for free, now we have to pay for, right? And so I don't want to get emails from GM. I've been getting an email from GM now probably once a day saying, hey, your subscription to OnStar has expired. Here are these really cool services that you have as long as you pay us. I don't care. If I wanted my OnStar services, I would activate it. Right? Don't subscribe me to something and then, you know, unsubscribe me to it and then force me to want to subscribe back to it. It's just too much. And everybody's doing that nowadays. And it goes all the way, this is a rant, of course. It goes all the way to like satisfaction surveys. If you really cared about my satisfaction, you wouldn't send me some automated BS survey, right? You would ask me when I'm having a bad experience and fix it. Just fix it. Don't expect me to fix your problems. And that's what this is, kind of a bigger picture, right? That's why I don't have any patience for having to go into a system and figure out why I'm getting the stupid home screen when I want my radio screen. Done.
Wow.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, let's bring back wooden wheels, crank starts, and no seatbelts. No. I agree. I think technology for the sake of technology.
That's not a good
argument. But here's the thing.
I disagree.
Here's the thing, right? I mean, you're arguing, there are certain things you made which are great points. I think that subscription-based services in cars, terrible idea. Hate that idea with all my passion. You are 100% right. This whole GM thing where you have to pay for connected navigation and remote start. I mean, it's just that I really dislike that. But what I disagree on is the ability to get more options and then have the option to turn them on and off. I mean, I think you are never going to be in a good place when you're arguing for less technology.
I'm especially not arguing for less. What I'm saying is, why couldn't you do it in such a way that, let's say I'm driving the Jaguar and I've got my radio screen on. I go to the store, buy the dog food, come back, and my radio screen's back on again.
Well, there's a setting in the system. Go change the setting.
Why does it come that way from the
factory?
Because
it doesn't know how you want it from the factory. Some people may like it to go to a home screen.
Really?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I don't want to go to the radio screen every time. I like to go to a home default screen. That's a preference of mine. You have a different preference, and that's why there's the option to turn it on.
So why does that learn?
Well, we have AI.
Every time I get in the car, first thing I do is go to the radio screen. Why doesn't it just say why does it say after like three of those things, hey, I've noticed that you like your radio screen on. Do you want to make that your default? I'd be like, yes, as opposed to having me have to go on Google and find out if that's it. And Tommy, this is a big if. You are assuming that there is a setting in that system that says you can change the home screen. I would bet there isn't.
A lot of times there is, though. I would bet
in the Jaguar and Defender system there isn't.
For example, like in that Mini system there's a way you can default the because actually this is pretty clever. This is just a fundamental difference between you and I. I think you like to get hands-on when you get a vehicle. You like to get in there, you like to drive it, you like to just do it yourself. When I get a vehicle, I'm all about, like, I sit down and I read the entire owner's manual from front to back, and I want to make sure that vehicle is tailored to my exact settings. And I think that, personally, that is a great way to do it. Just take the hour to take the time and set that car up. You just bought it. You're going to be excited about it. You're not going to be worried about the dog food because you just bought your new car. And then just get your user setup all set up, ready to go. Click the buttons you need to click, and then over the next 10 years you own the car, you never need to worry about it.
I think, like, actually it's worse than that. I think it takes away from the new car experience. I'm super excited to get it, and then I get in the car and the first thing I have to do is set up some system to my preferences that is nowhere near my preferences, and it takes away from my experience because all of a sudden now I'm working as opposed to playing, right? I'm so excited at this new car. Porsche did this recently where you had to create an account and log in, and every time you got that login account, that is so frustrating. Yeah, you just want to go. I mean, to me, the car isn't about the infotainment, especially like a Porsche. It's about the driving experience and about the great joy of rewarding yourself for something with something that, you know, you've earned by working hard. And then all of a sudden, the first thing it makes you do is work hard. I just want to go drive it. I don't want to have to tell Porsche who I am. I don't want to log into my car.
You have 10, 15, 20 years to enjoy that driving experience.
No,
take the hour, read the owner's manual.
No. First impressions are the most important. If my first impression is this car is already frustrating and unintuitive, I can't get past that.
Look, this is a fundamental.
Especially a car that is meant to be about the driving experience and not about, you know, the infotainment
this
experience.
This is a fundamental difference between you and I. For example, remember when I was a little guy, we went and bought a Jaguar, and they did the full walkthrough, and you just wanted it to be over because it was like 2 hours. You're like, I just want to go drive the car.
Because I knew more about the car than the salesman.
Yeah, but then in some case, that is true. But I've always been, because I'm a little bit nerdy and boring, but I'm a big proponent of before you go experience something, just read the owner's manual from front to back.
It's 500 pages.
Yeah, but that's okay. Learn how to use it. You mean you can fast forward through 300 of them, because 300 of them are going to be buckle your seatbelt and then don't, you know, take whatever
that's
before
why
you drive.
I don't want to read through that. I know all that.
But it's very important because, and then what you end up with is a very different experience with the car because you understand to the full extent how the engineer designed it.
Or you go down this rabbit hole that you're painting this picture like you're in Shangri-La, where you read the owner's manual and you are enlightened by the wisdom of the engineering team. The other thing that can happen, which also happens, is you go down this rabbit hole and you end up going down this hole that gets worse and worse and worse, where you try to figure out one thing which creates another problem, and then you try to solve that problem that creates another problem, and all of a sudden, once again, I'm working as opposed to driving. Let me ask you guys in the comments below, do you want to log into your car? I do not want to log. Do you want to log into your car, Tommy?
If it makes the user experience better, I'll do it once. Yeah, absolutely. I think
the
it's
Porsche
worth it.
Was multiple times. How about this one?
Well, that was not our Porsche, though. That was a press unit that had associated with someone else's account.
How about this one? The Santa Cruz? Mm-hmm. Every time we started, you have to agree to a terms of service. Every time.
That is annoying. I agree. That's annoying. But I still...
Why? Because some attorney somewhere decided that we're too stupid to, you know, to drive the car without suing Hyundai if something horrible happens. Look, why am I agreeing to terms of service when I'm just driving a car?
Volkswagen Touareg did that in 2004, too. We had to click the button once to clear it. I'm just saying, I think...
But every time in the Hyundai.
Yeah. Same thing with the Touareg. Every time. And BMW Systems had that for a long time, too. We had to clear it every time. I think when you own a vehicle... You learn how to operate it to the best of your abilities. And I'll give you an example. Here's why I like reading the owner's manual. We had that Ford F-150 Raptor, the SVT Raptor, 2014.
Right.
And had a feature you would never know about unless you read the owner's manual. If you push and held the traction control button a certain number of times in a certain order, you could actually completely disable the ABS system, which is a very, very cool piece of... tech, which would actually improve your driving experience. So these are not only things to hook up your phone, but they actually have a major impact on the driving experience of the automobile.
I can see the comments now. Wait, disabling ABS improves your driving experience?
Yes, because when you're out in the sand, it's a Baja truck.
Right.
You don't want ABS out in the sand. So you could be out in the Baja one day, and by reading the owner's manual, you might be able to stop and avoid that tree where you couldn't have if you didn't otherwise. And there'd be no other way to know that other than reading it.
So why do I have to keep agreeing to terms of service on the Hyundai? Shouldn't I just be able to do it once?
I mean, that's a lawyer thing. I think that's stupid. I agree. I think that's stupid, but that's just how it's set up.
No, but see, you just said it, right? That's just how it's set up. That is how it's set up, but I don't want a car that forces me to agree with that.
Well,
don't
buy it. Buy something else.
Well, that's why we're having this podcast. I think that Hyundai needs to understand that there are more people like me out there who find that incredibly annoying, and it's also in some ways dangerous, because what it does is the exact opposite of what a car should do. So let's say I leave my house and I want to change my channel. The first thing I do is I put in reverse, which turns off the radio, right?
Yeah, it turns on the life-saving backup camera.
It turns off the life-saving backup camera, yeah, potentially, right? Mm-hmm. Then I put it in drive, and now I want to like go and change the radio station because I'm not happy with the commercial that I've heard 5,000 times. And now I get this warning, and that warning won't go away probably for a good 5 seconds. So I'm sitting there staring at the warning, waiting for it to go away, because without getting rid of that warning, right, I can't change the radio station because it locks up the screen completely.
It's 5 seconds.
All it takes is 1 second to run over that cyclist that's coming down our road, right? Well, it's actually creating a more dangerous, potentially dangerous situation.
Well, just click OK. But it's done.
I don't want to click OK because I clicked OK yesterday and the day before and the day before. And at this point, I'm sick of clicking OK.
This is a major first world problem we're discussing here, Dad.
It's just stupid. It's just plain stupid.
You know, I'll give you another example. Like in this job, one of the most frustrating things are driver profiles and user profiles. And like, oh, you get into a car and then 19 people in front of you have driven it and set up their profile and it's totally different than what you want. You forget to save it and then it's constantly changing. But if you own that car, you would do it once at the dealership. Your husband does it once at the dealership or your significant other. And then you push the button, all your settings are saved like that. And you never think about it for the next 10 years you own the car. It's one of those things where I think it's all about the perspective of how you go into it. Read your owner's manual, people.
It sound like those settings are so simple to set up. Oh, you walk in there and you just, you know, like even getting to the point where you want to save those settings, right, is very frustrating and very complicated.
Not if you read the owner's manual. It'll tell you how to do it step by step.
I think you're going to get a lot of pushback on that.
It's there for a reason. Now, what I do agree with, which I think is a different conversation, but I think is a completely really bad can of worms, is subscription services in vehicles. So like we talked about how it used to be XM, and now it's sometimes XM and navigation, and now it's XM navigation and the phone app that controls the vehicle, and then it's XM navigation, phone app, and the remote start, like in the Tundra, off the key, right?
I am also so sick of XM.
I am sick of
SiriusXM.
I think that those subscription models are not my thing, because if I buy the truck or the car, I want to be able to own that vehicle.
I think we can talk about Sirius because it's a road trip tool, right? It's great to be able to. And this is something unique to America. You can't do satellite radio in Europe. In fact, you can't do it in Canada to some extent, because if you go too far north, you don't have the satellite coverage, right?
Europe doesn't have it.
Nope, they don't have satellite. I know that as a fact. But I am so sick of that company, and I'll tell you why. First of all, the promise was we won't put commercials on if you pay us a monthly fee. Well, that went out the window right away, right? So now some of the stations have commercials and some don't, and that was kind of a sliding scale where people begrudgingly accepted it. But what I hate about Sirius is like they charge you for all these services, and they have got all these plans which are more confusing than a cable stair-stepped, subscription service. And if you ever try to call them, you end up calling someplace in Calcutta where the person says their name is Joe, but it's really not, and you can tell that because they don't speak English very well. And if you let the subscription service die, they pester you with all kinds of requests and emails and mails telling you, hey, you know, your subscription service has died to XM. Here's the deal. And if you wait long enough, the $249 subscription service all of a sudden magically becomes $79. So, you know, it's like all the bad things of an automotive dealership wrapped up into a subscription service where you've got really bad customer service. You've got a business model that's set up to fleece you for as much money as possible. And then you've got a promise of no commercials with a ton of commercials. You know, if regular terrestrial radio wasn't so full of commercials, then Sirius would have no value whatsoever. But regular radio is so horrible that you're forced to have satellite radio just to be able to listen to a song without having to listen to, you know, the local carpet salesman trying to convince you that your carpets need replacing.
Yeah, SiriusXM is a terrible service. I don't like it. Well, but the solution is what all people are doing.
Spotify.
Yep, that's right. Just scream from your phone. Yep, that's where the world's moving to.
So, Sirius, you should take that into consideration next time you email me that you want $250 for an annual subscription do it for free on
Spotify. The interesting thing about Sirius is, you know, you can barter with them.
That's what I mean. I hate that.
It's like a Moroccan market.
It's like going to, like, exactly.
Sometimes
it's
$250, sometimes it's $90, sometimes it's $50, sometimes it's $300. It's like, depending on who you get and depending on how well you can barter with them, you can typically get a better deal.
And you know what sucks about that? you feel like taken advantage of, because you feel like the guy next to you probably got a better deal. It's like when you got an airplane, right? It just kind of gnaws at you, because you're like, I wonder if the guy next to me paid $50 for this ticket, whereas I paid $250, right? There's a sense of fairness that I have that goes out the window when you're dealing with people like Sirius.
Yep. Okay. Right, so what are some of your favorite road trip vehicles?
Like I said, trucks. I love trucks. The downside is there's not a lot of room for luggage if you're, you know, got a full vehicle, because you've got the bed and that's problematic. But now with the new Santa Cruz, and that's a great thing. It's got this tonneau cover where you could actually throw your luggage in there, and it's relatively safe. So let's talk about some of the great road trip vehicles. So for me, the vehicle has to be fuel efficient. It has to be comfortable on the road, right? Yep. And it has to be able to like consume giant swaths of land with one long drive.
So there's only one answer.
So like classic GTs, which are going the way of the dodo, right? Grand touring cars.
Those are not good road trippers. There's only one answer for the best road trip. Unanimously agreed upon.
What?
The minivan. Nothing better for a road trip than the minivan.
Oh, my God.
Especially the hybrid, the Sienna hybrid, the Pacifica plug-in hybrid.
So boring. Even sitting in it is so boring.
Well, you're just driving, though. You don't need – I mean, most of America is straight. I strongly believe this. You get a high driving position. You get decent fuel economy now.
You don't get that high.
It's pretty high.
Compared to a lifted truck, it's pretty low.
Yeah, but a lifted truck is going to get 15 miles per gallon. Your Sienna is going to do close to 30 in some instances. No, it's great. You got these big captain's chairs sometimes in the rear. It's great for passengers. You get a good view out the sides through the big windows. It's safe. They've got good safety ratings. Throw all your stuff in the back. Typically have pretty good technology now in 2022. It's the answer. A minivan is the single best road trip vehicle out there.
For me, it's like the classic Grand Tour, the GT, right? Bentley Continental GT.
Why? It's a terrible road trip vehicle. It's terrible fuel economy. You can only go the same.
It's suave you in leather and comfort.
You feel special
because you're driving this car that nobody else has on the road. You've got so much horsepower that if you want to pass cars, you just wink and you're past them. It just wafts down the road. Of course, this is a very expensive car. You know, you have to think of like more affordable versions of this.
Here's why Grand Tours just don't make sense for road trippers. Terrible fuel economy. What's the speed limit? You can go the same speed as anyone else.
85 on... is it 80 in Utah? That's pretty quick.
Yeah, a minivan will do 80 miles an hour just fine. And then you're dealing with rock chips through the Rocky Mountains constantly. You're going to break a windshield. The front end's going to get chipped. And then you make it to your Hampton Inn in Fresno and it gets stolen.
I would say that you actually bring up a good point. I would say that for me, any road trip car probably has to have all-wheel drive.
Well, what about the whole...
You can hit a winter storm in Colorado in June.
It gets stolen, wheels get stolen, it gets scratched, it gets hit. I mean, just expensive cars make it.
Well, so pick a GT that's not that expensive. Here's a good one that I've road tripped in and I absolutely loved. The Stinger. I love the Stinger. That to me is a classic GT.
Sure.
You don't like the Stinger?
Well, it's fine. I mean, it's a great car.
It's comfortable, it's fast, you feel it's like a shark among minnows.
It's a sports car, though, and it's got a firm suspension.
It's got changeable. It's changeable.
I'm not sure the Stinger would be my choice. No, I mean, the answer is a Sienna all-wheel drive.
Speaking of suspension, do you like it when you can change the suspension? Is that a good thing for road tripping, where you can go from, like, wafty soft to, like, race car firm?
Sure.
No?
Well, I mean, you said it yourself. You want to get as close to a full-size truck as you can get.
Here's another great road tripper.
Yeah.
All right? The Mercedes. I'm picking the expensive ones because I've road tripped Mercedes-Benz. S-Class.
Also
a
terrible.
A classic giant sedan.
Oh, no, my it's
God.
With,
get, that, with that big cushy pillow
that,
behind your
it's
head.
It's going to get damaged. That's the thing about road trippers.
Drive.
They get hit. They get scratched. They get the front ends.
Remember you did that video with Case where you had the EQS and he had the S-Class?
Yeah, I loved it. But it also wasn't my S-Class. If I had paid $100,000 for that thing, I'd be terrified. Terrified on a road trip. Because especially in Colorado, we get so many rock chips on the front of our vehicles. So many. And getting that on your new $120,000 Mercedes.
I mean, massaging seats, butt lifting, cheek lifting seats. So when your legs and your butt get tired.
Perfect road trip.
What's that?
The new Kia Carnival with the captain's chairs in the back.
How many minivans have you owned, Tommy?
Well, zero, because I don't go road tripping a lot. But if I did, it would be a minivan. Mm. Seriously, they are the best. And in the back, the seats can – a lot of – like, remember the old Town and Countries, the seats would face each other?
So remember we
– So good for kids. Power in the back, TVs in the back.
So remember we went on a – on a road trip in a Nissan Quest. Do you remember that?
Best road trip we've ever had.
Went to Cannon Beach.
The thing was awesome.
In Portland, and we said, you were just a youngster, and you could drive on the beach there legally. So we said, hey, let's take this on the beach. And the thing got stuck, and the tide started coming in. And then I had to have, like, 15 people help me actually, like, push it off the beach so it wouldn't flood before the water came
well,
in.
Well, get an all-wheel drive minivan. That was the issue we made there, is the front-wheel drive minivan.
I wasn't, like, in love with that thing as a road trip.
It was great. It was the best road tripper. You also took that huge road trip in that Chrysler Pacifica with Mom.
Yeah.
And she came – that was the only – you know, we've been doing this for 12 years, and the only car Mom has ever said she liked is a Chrysler Pacifica plug-in hybrid.
I just can't –
we brought home Bentleys and Rivians and nope. Chrysler Pacifica plug-in hybrid. That's the car she liked. Mm. Because they're comfortable and you sit high and it's got big windows and it's quiet and it's pretty fuel efficient and oof.
Well, that was actually a plug-in hybrid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
So,
thing's awesome.
So given a choice, if I'm going to compare two cars like a Wrangler or a Pacifica plug-in hybrid or a Wrangler 4xe, I'll take the Pacifica plug-in hybrid as a road trip car.
There you go.
But it would be far, far down my list. Because I want something that's cool. The other thing about road tripping with a vehicle is that you get to know it really well and you get to spend a lot of time in it. And so it's like you want to go on a road trip with, you know, the friend that is fun and is easygoing and, you know, loves road tripping. And I don't think, to me, that's the minivan. To me, the minivan is kind of boring and very functional, right? It's like the librarian. I don't want to go road tripping with a librarian. I want to go road tripping with the person and the personality of a car that's going to excite me, not that's going to bore me.
Here's the thing. Everybody thinks a road trip, and will culminate with them cruising down PCH in their convertible top down with the big V8 blaring on straight pipes, and, you know, their friends sticking out the top, and that's the idyllic road trip. But the reality of the road trip is you're going through Kansas for 9 hours, and it's gray and dreary and raining, and you just
want
to be comfortable.
That's why you want that friend who's like the party girl or guy.
It doesn't matter if they're in the car. You're still going through Kansas when it's raining, and then your V8 classic car breaks down.
I have to say the best road trip I took was in our Hellcat when we drove to California. Every time I thought about driving that thing, I got excited because I was in a Hellcat. That's what made it fun for road tripping. So for me personally, all that practicality that we're talking about, the usual kind of like Consumer Reports advice, I've gotten to the point where I'm like, throw that out the window. Go get yourself the most fun, the coolest, the most unique car you can, so that every time you get in the thing, you're like super excited to drive it. I remember driving that Hellcat on our road trip. So we drove from here to San Francisco, then down to LA, and then back to Colorado. So we did this big like 3,000-mile circuit, right? And you got to admit, it was such a hoot to drive that thing down the highway because it had that burbling, you know, 707 horsepower V8, and every time you looked at the accelerator, you would just go flying by traffic.
No,
it was incredible.
It was not incredible because we were doing 77 miles an hour the whole time, getting passed by everybody because I didn't want to.
I went faster in stretches.
You did not. I was watching that. You maybe hit 81, and then it was too fast.
Oh, no.
Yes, Tom, you did. No. That you were the most conservative driver. My dad does this thing where he goes online and pretends like, oh, I'm very cool and drive fast. But you know, you the most important thing in your job is your license. So you and I both are very conservative drivers. Very conservative drivers. So we were not going very fast for the vast majority.
Do manufacturers listen to this podcast?
No, it's true. We are very conservative drivers. It absolutely is true. Hey, sorry for the weird interruption, but we had some audio difficulties at this point in the podcast. And now we are going to transition to our camera audio, which is probably going to sound a little different. Sorry about that. The next one will be back to its usual high quality audio for the entire podcast.
I mean, every now and then you'll get on it, going on an on-ramp, but then you're right back at 79 because you have to be. That's the most important thing in this job, is keeping your driver's license.
So I've come full circle. I think if you want to go get yourself a McLaren 720S and just, you know, bomb across the country, go for it.
Well, we also talk about fuel economy,
Having said that, some of the cars that we road trip are horrible just because of how hard they are to drive. So the last me and Nathan did this video where we did a race. It was kind of a Top Gear-like race where he flew to Aspen and I drove the previous generation Mustang GT500, mm-hmm. a manual. Oh my God, was that a horrible car to drive. That clutch was like driving a garbage truck. It was that heavy. It was just a really miserable car to drive. I felt like I needed to be Arnold Schwarzenegger to get behind the wheel. It was not great. And it was cool, but you know, if the car is cool, but it's got some inherent issues.
Like fuel economy.
No. Comfort issues. For me, it's always about comfort, right? So I'll give you another example. We talked about this, but like I just drove the GT4 RS, which is a track car. I think that would be the world's worst road tripping car because you would have this giant intake above your head where it's getting this fast amount of air, right? Just sucking air past your ears the whole time. You'd get so tired so quickly.
I think especially now that you can't discount fuel economy. It's one thing to say, you'll just pay a little bit more.
Right, let's talk about that.
When you're on the road and you have that $200 fuel bill.
Okay, let's talk about that. How about electric cars? If you want to save...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so how are electric cars to road trip? We've done a whole bunch of them.
It depends on your route. If you are on any of the main highways, it's mostly fine. And if you have an electric car that charges quickly, like that Hyundai Ioniq 5, 10 to 80% in 18 minutes, it really isn't that big of a deal. You're just going to be spending a little bit extra time in Walmart parking lots, typically, than you rather would.
So I'm torn because I'm one of these people who, when I get in a car, I get like the destination in my head, and I want to get there.
Yeah, because you, yeah.
I always think to myself, Roman, you should enjoy the journey, and
no, you should.
The destination is not the journey. The journey is a journey, but I'm just so driven to get there. And then I look at like the Better Route Planner, which is this planner that tells you how long you charge when you're driving an electric car, and I compare the time it takes for me to, like, remember we drove from California, from LA, we drove the Jeep Wrangler that we bought, which was a TJ, right? We bought a TJ.
Yep.
And we did it in one long stretch, and I think it took us, we left like at 6 in the morning from LA, and we got into Denver, we got into Boulder at what, like 2 in the morning, something like that?
Mm-hmm.
If that was an electric car, we would have gotten into Denver like at 7 in the morning.
Right, you have to plan additional time for an EV, certainly. That's
and that to me is just
about
a waste
the journey,
of time.
Though. Like this trip I took with Kier, the destination was kind of crappy.
Yeah.
I didn't like the destination very much. Dinosaur National Monument is just a bunch of dinosaur bones, which is great if you're into dinosaurs.
If you're...
But I thought that the journey was a lot of fun, so that's a case where I was really in it for the journey. I mean, every road trip's about the journey, I think.
Yeah, but it seems, I try to fake myself when I road trip on your car into thinking, you know what? It's great to get out and stretch your legs every few hundred miles. And then the first time you do it and you stop at a Walmart parking lot for Electrify America, Tesla's a little better, right? They usually are in more interesting locations. But there are a lot of places in the West here where there's just not a lot of interesting locations. But let's say you're on Electrify America and you stop at the Walmart and you're like, okay, now I got, if it's a short stay, maybe 20 minutes, if it's a long stay, 30 minutes. To do nothing but wait for this thing to charge. So I go into a Walmart and I'll get myself like a Starbucks or something. The first time you do that is good, but on a 1,000-mile road trip, the 15th time you've done that or whatever it is, it's just kind of sucky. You just want to get on the road and drive, right? By the time you get to Colorado, let's say you drive from LA and you've done that now 5 times, you're like, oh God, I just want to get this over with.
It depends. I mean, if you have the time to do it, I think it's a lot of fun. If you are in a rush to get, which we're always in a rush to get to our destination, it doesn't work very well. But, my choice for any road trip is still going to be the hybrid all-wheel drive minivan. So Toyota Sienna.
We're going to Europe to drive a Mini, and I was just thinking to myself this morning, like, I'm kind of happy it's not the electric Mini, because I love the electric Mini, but it's only got 114 miles of range, right? So it's nice to have that freedom to be able to either take your time or if you want, just bomb it and get there.
All right. Well, guys, let us know what you think about this in the comment section.
Are we done?
Pretty much done.
What's your perfect before we
I just told you. Toyota Sienna.
I don't believe that. I think you're saying that just for the...
No, it's true. I mean, I want to give good consumer advice here, and that is the perfect road trip vehicle. It's big, it's comfortable, it's got good gas mileage, it's going to be dirt reliable, plenty of room for your friends, your kids, your family, anything you want in there. You can put stuff on the roof, you can put stuff in the trunk. It is the best road tripper.
All right, out of our fleet, what would you take? We don't have a minivan, so what? Now you're going to road trip to, let's say you're going to road trip someplace far. Let's say you're going to road trip to New York, which is far. What are you going to take?
Well, if you're paying for gas, probably the ZR2.
No, you're paying for gas. You can have any car you want, but you're paying for gas. You can have your Mini GP.
No, God, no cruise control.
Okay.
All
right. You can do your Volkswagen convertible. You could do some of the 80s cars that we have. You could do some of the trucks. So what car would you take? But you're paying for gas.
Yeah, probably the Bronco. I think it's the best.
Really?
It's the best compromise that we have currently.
Not your own Wrangler.
No. The seats are too bad. I think that the Bronco is a good compromise. I mean, we have a very unfuel efficient fleet. But it's a good compromise between size, space, comfort, and efficiency.
Well, our Mini SE is very fuel efficient.
Yeah, but that only, I mean, 100, and, so the thing about road tripping an electric car is you got a road trip an electric car that was built to be road tripped. Like, the Cooper SC was never intended to be road tripped.
It's a city car.
It fast charges way too slowly. An Ioniq 5, on the other hand, I would take that in a heartbeat because it's got a huge, hugely fast charging curve, and it's just, it's a monster. But of our fleet, probably the Bronco.
Okay.
Because I think the ZR2, it'd be a little better, but it's just too
unfortunate. Keep in mind, your Wrangler is also a two-door and short wheelbase.
Yeah, even the four-door.
And it's a soft top, so it gets loud.
Even the four-door, the seats are too bad.
Yeah, Jim needs to work on those seats. Jim, if you're listening, love you, dude, but you need to fix those seats. They're just a little too rough for road trips.
Yep, that's my choice. What's your choice?
Well, if I had my dithers and the company were paying for the gas, I'd take the TRX, no doubt.
Boy, that was not what you were paying for the gas.
So if I'm paying for the gas, you know what road trip I enjoyed the most that we did? It was a 944 Turbo.
Yes, and that
we drove that from Phoenix to Colorado, and I really love that.
The thing about classic cars, they are a ton of fun.
When they work.
Yeah. I struggle with them a little bit in retrospect. I'm always like, wow, what a great road trip. When I'm doing it, I find myself looking at the alternator gauge and the oil pressure just constantly waiting for something to break. And then, of course, like the headlights failed partway through. Remember, that was not a good thing. So that is an adventure for sure. It makes a road trip an adventure.
But one of the headlights stopped popping up.
Well, both of them did.
Yeah, at night when they fail, that's always... But sometimes the more involved you are with the car, the more fun it is.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good adventure.
But in the middle of nowhere, Arizona, with no lights on the car.
Yeah, it can be kind of stressful. So that's my deal with classic cars. I think they're great adventures, but you're always kind of worried about it.
I'll tell you what I would take. So we have the FJ.
Yeah.
That car just is horrible on fuel economy, plus it's bad sight lines. It's a really cool car, but I think it's probably the worst road trip car.
I took that on about a 600-mile road trip.
Yeah, I know. How was it?
It was lovely.
Really?
Really bad fuel economy, really bad sight lines. Yeah. But it's got a good ride, and it's got really good seats. Mm. So that's what made up for it. I'd actually take an FJ over a Wrangler on a road trip because of the good seats. They really are good seats in the Toyota. So you still have to answer the question.
Like I said, so if it was my money, huh?
Well, you could take your Golf R. You like that thing?
Yeah, I thought about the Golf. The problem with the Golf R is it's so high strung. On the highway, it's if I'm doing like 75, it's doing like 3,500 RPM,
yeah,
and
that's
that gets really old after a while. Like, you know, it's more of a kind of a short point and shoot car as opposed to the long road trip car.
Sounds like we need to buy a Sienna.
I take the TRX, or if not, I take the ZR2. I think that's a really good truck.
I agree.
Really comfortable. And then you want to tell them what car we just bought for a Classics channel before we wrap this up?
Yeah, so we've got this coming up. It won't be up before this goes live. It'll be up soon. It's a 76 Toyota FJ40, the original Land Cruiser. Very cool stuff.
Yeah, we just bought that. It's kind of a barn find. It runs and dries, but it's pretty rough.
Yeah.
Thanks to our friend Alan from Denver East Machinery Company, right? He's sponsoring our Taming Tumbleweed series. So it was his vehicle that he got out of a monastery in Snowmass, Colorado.
Yeah,
where Mr. Munster lived for 15 years.
Silent Monks, which is a pretty cool thing. So yeah, we've got a lot of fun content coming with that. And we're going to go do some family stuff in Europe when we're out there. And then we will... see you on the next podcast.
Yeah, and then we come back, and actually, you get to drive the new Bronco Raptor.
That's exactly
you're
right.
Palm Springs. Palm Springs,
yeah,
wow.
We're going to do some off-roading in that. It'll be a fun trip.
And Andre's going to go drive the Escalade the V, and I'm going to go drive the new Cadillac Lyric. So a lot of cool stuff coming up.
Love it.
All right, see you guys next time. Ciao.
Save big money at Menards. Gorilla tapes, glues, and adhesives are perfect for jobs around the house, indoors and out. Gorilla Heavy Duty Construction Adhesive has a 100% waterproof formula that provides a secure bond on any surface. From trim work to landscape block to hanging mirrors, it's all-purpose and holds in 30 seconds. Pick it up for your project and head to Menards.com to see all of our great deals going on now.
Save big money at Menards.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up.
CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.